Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Anybody can call with any question they got about the Catholic Church, the Catholic faith, any questions about the Bible, about morals. We're here to take all questions today. 888-318-7884 is the number, as in the first hour, so in the second hour. Jimmy Akin is our guest, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, how are you doing, Si?
I am doing very well. I'm happy to be planted here next to you and answering questions from folks all over. And
it's good to be planted somewhere.
Just bloom where you're planted.
Exactly.
I think that's the advice.
St. Paul said something like that.
Okay, really? So now, what did St. Paul say?
Well, he said, don't let whatever station you have in life at the time you're converted trouble you. So if you're married, that's fine. Live a good married life. If you're not married, that can be fine too. If you don't feel the need to get married, you don't have to. You don't got to worry about that. If you're a slave at the time that you're converted, don't let that stress you. Though he says, you know, if you can obtain your freedom, do. If you're a freeman at the time, you know, live as the Lord's servant. So don't worry about your state, bloom where you're planted, in essence. But also, he didn't say you must stay where you're planted. Because he acknowledged that if you feel the need to get married, you can. Or if you're a slave and you can get your freedom, then do. Mm-hmm. But don't stress about it.
Because church is not about reaching some station or something
right,
like that.
Right, about a particular station of earthly life. Yeah. And in the ancient world, you know, there were a lot of limitations on people's ability. They did not have a lot of social mobility.
Right.
And so the thought that I've got to achieve a certain state might not be practical. And Paul's saying you can please God no matter what kind of set of cards you've been dealt in life.
And that's true today as it was then.
So bloom where you're planted.
All right. We go now to James in Houston, Texas, planted on EWTN on 1430 AM. James, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Thanks for having me. Full disclosure, it's day four of being Catholic. So
hey, what?
Congratulations.
Wow. All right. Well, we don't want to break the streak.
Well, the show was recommended to me probably because of my incessant questioning during RCIA, but I'll softball this one to you. I was, you know, kind of meditating on the mystery of the Trinity, and I get frustrated sometimes because people end up inevitably saying, well, it's a mystery. And I go, well, I still want to joust with it a bit, tilt at some windmills. But if we're made in the image of God, would there be an analogous Trinity within us? And I ask that because, you know, sometimes my body's tired, but I'll have the willpower to go out and jog or exercise, and the other days I won't. And sometimes my mind knows, hey, body, don't eat this. And my body's like, I'm going to it. It just seems like they're all at war with each other. But in that sense, I feel like I can kind of understand this paradox of one and three and three and one, but I could just be making this all up.
Well, just because you're making it all up doesn't mean that there's not points of contact, and thus something of an analogy. You can make analogies between any two things that have similarities, and the similarities between the two things are you know, what enable the analogy to happen. The temptation that we have to avoid is reading more into the analogy than the points of contact allow. And this is particularly the case with the doctrine of the Trinity, because this is something that fundamentally transcends human experience in this life. There's nothing, strictly speaking, there's nothing like the Trinity that is part of our experience. It's something that we will have to wait until the next life unless God gives you some kind of infused knowledge in this life, it's something we're going to have to wait until the next life to have a clearer experience of. Having said that, there are things in this world that experience a sense of where we experience a sense of multiplicity, like you mentioned, you know, your body can be tired, but you can will to go jogging anyway, or feeling like maybe I should eat this, maybe I shouldn't, but I'm going to. And so, yeah, duality or multiplicity is part of the human experience. And, okay, there is a multiplicity involved in the Trinity. There are three persons. So there are multiple persons in the Trinity. Also, we are, as individuals, one. And so even though we experience some multiplicity, we're ultimately one individual. And in analogously, God is one God. So you can say, well, here with the human person, there is a sense in which we're one and a sense in which we're multiple. And with God, there is a sense in which God is one and a sense in which God is multiple. And so to that extent, you can draw an analogy between the two, but it can't go much further because God is not just a human being. And when you start analyzing the sense in which we're one versus multiple and the sense in which God is one versus multiple, they're not the same. One way in which they're not the same is you mentioned how in our own experience of multiplicity, we can have a kind of war or tension between the different elements that are part of us. So you could have a tired body but a firm will. Or you could have a pang of conscience about what you're about to eat, but a resolve to eat it anyway. And so in those situations, there's tension between the two different things in both cases. But there's no tension at all between the persons of the Godhead. So that's one way in which the analogy doesn't go much further. More fundamentally, though, we are a single person and a single being. A being is something that exists, something that bees is a being. And so each one of us is a being, and we're also one person, but we're composite beings so that we have parts like a body versus a spirit, or an arm versus a leg versus a head, or an intellect versus a will versus a sensitive faculty in our minds. So we have these different parts because we're composite. God is not composite, so he doesn't have parts the way we do. And whereas God is one being, and that is analogous to the fact that we're one being, where his multiplicity comes in is on the level of person. And this is why the Trinity is so unfamiliar to us, and it's kind of on the edge of our ability to understand it. But if you think about it, a person and a being are two separate categories. So some things are being. Like here in the studio, we have a plant, and that plant is one being, but it's also zero persons. And so whereas Psi is one being and one person. So if you can have some beings that are zero persons and some beings that are one person, then person and being are different categories, and there's no reason you can't have some beings that are more than one person. And that's what God is. God is one being in three persons. And unfortunately for our ability to conceptualize the Trinity, even though we can see that these are different logical categories, and so you know, we can see that it's possible to have one being who's three persons, it doesn't make it easy for us to visualize because there's nothing else in the universe like that, not that we've met. And so since our imagination and our ability to conceptualize things is based on our experience, and we haven't had direct experience of a tri-personal single being before, that means we can understand it when God tells us about it, but we can't easily visualize it. It's kind of like trying to visualize a hypercube. You know, a hypercube is a four-dimensional cube, and we can understand the mathematics involved in a hypercube. We can even tell you the formula for, like, what's the hypervolume of a hypercube. It's S to the fourth.
I was going to say – oh, I was so close. I was going to say S to the
like
fourth.
The volume of a
– because, you know, math is my strong suit.
The length of a line is just S, and area of a square is S squared, and the area of a cube is S cubed. And so the hypervolume of a hypercube is S to the fourth. But because we live in a world with three observable spatial dimensions, we can understand the mathematics of a hypercube, but we can't visualize one in our heads because that's just outside of our experience. Our minds aren't set up in this life to visualize four-dimensional objects. And in the same way, we can understand certain things about God, but we still can't visualize it. And we try to use analogies to help, but we have to be really strict about the limits of those analogies when they apply to God.
Stay right there. We'll be back with more Catholic Answers Live open forum right after this. James, thanks very much for your question, but we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
This is Harry Connick Jr., and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
As legend tells it, 500 years ago, a disaffected Augustinian priest nailed his 95 theses to the door of the Wittenberg Cathedral. The evidence that he actually did this is pretty thin, but Martin Luther's objections to Catholic teachings concerning purgatory and indulgences set off a series of countless ruptures that the Church suffers to this very day. The faithful Catholic wants to be God's instrument in healing these ruptures, but may not know where to begin. Join us this September 28th to 30th as we tackle the topic at Catholic Answers' 4th National Apologetics Conference, The Reunion of All Christians, a lively and inspiring conference designed to ignite and inform your faith. We've got an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to fire you up. Catholic historian Steve Weidenkopf, apologist Mark Brumley, apologist Devin Rose, plus all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. This is an event you don't want to miss. This is where it all begins. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to leave you wanting more. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today to register. That's CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Have you visited Catholic.com lately? We've got a whole new look, better navigation than ever before, and lots of great new features to make your Catholic.com experience one that will have you coming back again and again. You'll find the answers to thousands of questions on all things Catholic, and our extensive library of audios, videos, tracts, articles, and more gets larger every day. When you need answers about the Catholic faith, turn to someone you can trust. Catholic.com, the most trusted destination in Catholic apologetics. That's Catholic.com.
Call now with your question. 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. Open Forum means any question you've got on the life or the faith or the history of the Catholic Church. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist at Catholic Answers, our guest this hour. And let's go to Jason in Pasadena, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Jason, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question has to do with an interpretation of the parable of the sower.
Okay.
So if we were to consider that God features in that parable not only as a sower, but also as the creator of the different types of soils, does this mean that people's salvation and damnation are fixed in eternity by God? Thank you.
Okay. So there are a couple of problems with that interpretation. The first one is a question of, is God functioning as creator in this parable? Because in the parable, the sower could be identified as the Son of Man, or could be identified as anybody going out sowing, but the role of creation is not here. and the world and the soil types and the seed and the birds, and it's all a given in this parable. And this is actually kind of a good follow-up call to some previous discussion we were having on today's show about the limits of analogies, because when you look at the parables, you have to take them on their own terms, and you can't just read in other things you know. So in the case of the parable of the sower, you have somebody preaching the word of God, that's the seed, and then it's heard by different people. And we know theologically that, okay, God is the creator, but we don't have in this parable, there was this sower, and the sower went out to sow seed, and he also created the world. You know, that would, that if we had explicit references to the sower not just sowing the seed, but creating the seed and creating the soil types, and then all these scenarios playing out, then you'd have more of a case. But since we don't find that in the parable, it's not legitimate to read in that outside knowledge when trying to understand it, because it's not presented to us that way. If Jesus wanted to present it to us that way, he could have, and he didn't. And since he didn't, that suggests he's not trying to teach us here a message about God determining the eternal fates of everybody. What he's teaching us is how our response to the gospel determines our fate. But he's not going into the question of, is our response fixed, or by whom is it fixed? And so we have to approach that question not simply looking at the parable, but looking at the situation more broadly in theological terms. And so but let's stick with the question for just a minute. Suppose we did say that the sower in this parable is God and is the creator. Would that mean, based on this parable, that God determines our reactions and therefore our fates? Only if God doesn't also create free will. Because otherwise, I mean, you can say, well, there are these different soil types, and they symbolize people who have different reactions. But if God gave us free will, then he didn't determine our fates, not in that way. and so consequently, if he's given us free will, then we aren't simply puppets, and this parable does not show that. So you would need not only to show that God's the creator of the soil types, but he's also the one that assigns specific individuals to soil types in a way that they don't have freedom. And since this parable doesn't go that far, it doesn't say these things. It doesn't say that God created the soil types and assigned people to them without them having free will. Therefore, it reads into the parable those concepts, if you want to propose them, on the basis of the parable. That's a process that's often referred to as eisegesis, which means reading into a text instead of interpreting the text. And so that's a basic sketch of what I have to say there.
Jason?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, good. I'm glad that made sense to you. We go now to Doug in Trenton, New Jersey, listening on EWTN. I think I made you wait for a while, Doug. I apologize for that. What's your question for Jimmy?
Oh, that's all right. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, my name is Doug.
Okay, Doug, you know, we don't do last names on this show, and we don't endorse YouTube channels or websites we haven't had the experience of. And if I recall correctly, we had a call very much like this last week, possibly from you. If it was you, and I'm getting the sign that it was you, you're a bad actor, I'm afraid, Doug, because we explained this to you last time you called in. You called in with a question that you told the call screener and did not proceed to ask. You were lying to the call screener, and I'm sorry, but we're not going to allow that to happen, and we will take the steps needed to prevent it from happening. So don't waste your time, and God bless you.
And I apologize for making him wait so long, and
yeah,
he still
he's
dumped
still
that.
A bad actor.
Well, maybe if there's another Doug from Trenton, New Jersey, who calls now, we're not going to let him on. So he just ruined it for all the other drugs.
We can be discerning here, but we're
no. How am I going to know? Well, let's go to John.
There are things we can do. Yeah, but we're not going to say what they are.
Oh, we have top secret security things we'll do. John in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. As long as you're not going to push a website, John, what's your question for Jimmy Akin?
Yeah, my question for Jimmy Akin is essentially, I wanted to know the church's stance on attending a wedding that's not Catholic. Mm-hmm. I am a Catholic myself, but the scenario is that my niece is getting married, mm-hmm. and she's marrying someone who was raised Catholic mm-hmm. to start, but was never actually confirmed.
Okay.
And so they're not getting married in the Catholic Church, and I just want to know what the church's stance is on that type of scenario.
The church does not have a passage in canon law addressing this directly, and I wish it did, but it doesn't. There's no specific law I can point to on the books. What there is a canon that says that the faithful in just their ordinary patterns of activity in daily life always need to maintain communion with the church. And so that's going to mean not doing things that are inconsistent with life as a Catholic. But there's no specific text that addresses this kind of situation. So what one has to do at that point is to figure out what the best thing possible to do is in a situation like this. And that's not always easy to figure that out. In this situation, if the person was originally Catholic but never confirmed, then it can be the person may be acting in good conscience. Their parents may have taken them to church or had them baptized and then not raised them Catholic or not done so effectively. And so the person may not realize that they need to get married in the Catholic Church, and they may be acting in good conscience in that respect. But the way the church's law is written at present, their marriage would not be valid unless they obtain a dispensation from observing the Catholic form of marriage. And ordinarily, going to a marriage that's not going to be valid is a disservice to the parties involved because it communicates to them that you think their marriage is valid when in fact it's not. So it puts family members in all kinds of difficult and uncomfortable situations when other family members are going into a marriage that's known by the informed Catholic party to be invalid from the get-go. It can make it very difficult. Sometimes people will argue, well, it's better to maintain bridges with people by going to their invalid wedding. That's a tough argument to make, though. One can easily argue that the thing that would be better is to be honest with them and to show that these things matter by saying, you know, as much as I love you and I'm there for you and I'm there for you whether you get married or not, or whether you attempt this wedding or not, the fact is that you need to do this in the church. And if you don't, it's not going to be valid, and I can't be there. And as a result, that's how I'm showing I love you, because I want you to understand the reality of the situation. And as painful as it is, my love for you means I don't want to show up and communicate to you that what you're doing is okay when it's not.
Very good. And the fact that he was initially raised Catholic as a youth, but never taken through confirmation and the other sacraments, et cetera.
Does not matter.
Doesn't have anything to do with it being valid or not. This would be considered invalid.
This would be invalid because he is – now, is your niece Catholic?
My niece is not Catholic,
okay.
No.
The fact that he is Catholic in the sense that he was baptized or received into the Catholic Church means that he's subject to the laws of the church. And one of them is just like the state can require you to fill out some paperwork, you know, to get a marriage license in order to be validly married under the state's law. He's a citizen of the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church has an equivalent to that. Instead of taking out a marriage license, what the Catholic Church expects is that you either observe the Catholic form of marriage or get a dispensation from that form. So those, for him to have a valid marriage, those would be the two options. He either needs to have a Catholic wedding or he needs to get a dispensation from his bishop to have a non-Catholic wedding.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And one quick follow-up question, if I may.
Mm-hmm. Real quick.
Very quickly. Now, as I
we're at a hard break, so what's the question?
It's got to be quick.
Okay, absolutely. If a Catholic then formally leaves the Catholic Church, joins another one, and then gets married,
The way the Church's law is presently written, that doesn't make any difference. If you've ever been baptized or received into the Catholic Church, then this law applies to you the way the law is currently written.
Excellent. Well, thank you for everything, guys. I love the show.
No problem.
Thank you very, very much.
And God bless you, and ask people to pray for you and everyone in similar situations.
888-318-7884, the number. If you're watching on YouTube, Facebook, or Periscope, you can type your questions in there, and we will try to get to them. But you can also use that phone number. The good old phone is probably the best way to get us. 888-318-7884. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with our guest, Jimmy Akin, senior apologist at Catholic Answers, right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Christian men, beware. With the idols of materialism, entertainment, and the flesh, it's plain to see that the world wants you for its own. Face it, it's tempting and easy to be a man of the world. Father Terence Ehrman has a challenge for you. Be a man of God instead. In his new book, Man of God, Lessons to Young Men About Life, Sex, Friendship, Vocation, and Loving with the Heart of Christ, Father Ehrman draws on his experiences counseling men who are struggling to live in the world but not be of the world. In a unique format, he offers a plan for ongoing conversion, holy spiritual direction for all men who want to master themselves and be transformed from within. Order your copy of Man of God today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking new resource by apologist Trent Horn, that one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. In a series of short, easy-to-read chapters, Trent covers the whole range of common topics, starting with why we believe in anything at all and answering all the common objections to the Catholic faith, both doctrinal and moral. Don't miss out on the most important, life-changing book to come along in years. Better yet, it's only $3 a copy when you order in bulk. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Encounter with Dan Demite and Patrick Rice.
The Holy Spirit is about a new and exciting work in the church of today. On Encounter, we bring young adults the life-changing testimonies of ordinary people that launch them into lives of extraordinary mission, bringing heaven down to earth. Activate the power of God in your spiritual life on Encounter.
Encounter with Dan Demite and Patrick Rice. Debut Saturday, July 29th, 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. This music makes me want to talk really fast.
Think of the Beach Boys.
Well, that's feels like the Beach Boys found
Beach
you.
Boys,
yeah, this wouldn't make it into the Rockabilly Hall of Fame, but it might make it into the Surf Music Hall of Fame. I wonder if there is one of those.
The Surf Music Hall of Fame? I don't know.
Yeah. I know there's a Surfing Hall of Fame.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised.
I'm not in it.
Maybe they have a music department.
Yeah, perhaps they do. 888-31-TRUTH is our number. If you would like to get on the line, I strongly suggest you do it right now, because I think we got a half hour left, and we will try to get to all these calls, but can't make any promises at this point. We go now.
People can call back another day.
Yeah, because we do this every Tuesday and Thursday.
Yeah.
The open forums. And that's right. Any Tuesday or Thursday, you wake up and you say to yourself, I got a Catholic question. then you know by the afternoon you're going to have a place you can take that
to. And the way to do it to kind of make sure you get in is call early. So like a couple minutes before the show and, you know, and that way the lines will be open for you.
We go now to Beth in Madison, Wisconsin, listening to EWTN on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Beth, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. I was just calling to ask. I was in a sorority in college before I was Catholic.
Okay.
And it was just a normal Greek sorority. And I actually left the sorority before I graduated, so mm-hmm. I'm no longer like a member in good standing. So fast forward, and
did
I became Catholic.
Give you the memorio damne, or I mean, like have your name stricken from the monuments, or
you know, no. I'm not sure.
Okay,
I definitely not allowed to wear the letters anymore. That was made clear. But I became Catholic later, and mm-hmm. now that I've kind of thought back on that time, I realized that there are some things that I wouldn't be comfortable with now as a Catholic. Mm-hmm. We said oaths and invoked like the name of Hera, like the Greek goddess.
Oh.
It's very weird looking back.
This is never having been in a sorority myself, I don't know. Is that normal for sororities or was that just something that yours did to your knowledge?
Well, it's all very secretive, so I'm not mm-hmm.
not sure.
I'm not really privy to the other sororities, but they.
Okay.
I know that we weren't alone in our use of Greek imagery.
Oh well, sure. It's called the Greek system, so. That
right. So I think it's pretty common. Mm-hmm. Not knowing exactly, but it didn't. From what I know, I think it's pretty common.
Okay.
So there's like the swearing an oath when using invoking the name of Hera, and then there's just some other things that are definitely not okay mm-hmm. with our Catholic faith. And so now
some of the partying that goes on in some of these places, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've only seen it in movies.
Well, yeah.
Me too.
I've never been to a fraternity or sorority party.
I've driven in front of them, but I've never been to
I wonder
one.
If I was just too nerdy for it. No, I don't think
I was definitely too
I don't think we had them
it.
At Boston College. I don't think they had.
Oh, really?
I can't remember now, but I don't think they had them.
No, we definitely had them at the University of Arkansas.
And no one invited you. Well, Beth, you're so much less nerdy than us. But we should probably address
you're
your question at some
girls.
Point.
Yeah. So what's the question?
Well, so now I have some items left over from those days, like my jewelry and my pins that mm-hmm. are expensive. Mm. But I don't want to keep them. I don't want my daughter one day to find them and get interested and have to explain it all to her.
Okay.
But I'm not sure now what to do with them. My first instinct was to donate them to somebody, you know, who was entering the sorority and would be able to afford it. But then I also don't want to condone the sorority at all. So okay. I'm just not sure what to do.
Well, I sympathize with this. I have similar dilemmas periodically. Like I have a lot of books. And being an apologist, I have books in my library that have views in them that are very contrary to the Christian faith. You know, it's part of my job to interact with such views, and so I need to have access to arguments of people putting these views forward. And so periodically when I need to purge my library and say get rid of books I'm not using because I have limited space, I have this question of, well, what am I going to do with this book? If it's compatible with the Catholic faith, I could sell it. You know, I could take it to a used bookstore. But some of them aren't. And so – and then there's some kind of on the brink books. You know, it's like it's not fully compatible, but it's not really spiritual poison either. You know, and what do you do with that? So what I do is if it's firmly and definitely incompatible, I throw it away. And if it's compatible with Christian faith, I may sell it or donate it to somebody. If it's iffy, I take my best guess and then entrust the decision to God and then don't worry about it after that because I've already made my best decision and that's what God expects of me, without scrupling about it. In terms of these things, you know, I don't know what the nature of the sorority. I don't know enough about the sorority system, frankly, to know specifically what you may have in mind. Some things like invoking Greek deities. I was surprised a number of years ago, and I learned this actually from a pro-life doctor, Dr. John Wilkie, people may remember he's passed on now, but he was head of the major pro-life organization here in America. I believe he was Catholic, And I was surprised to learn, listening to him once, that when the Hippocratic Oath was taken by doctors, and apparently it's, I gather it's not taken by all doctors now.
Right.
But when it was, it would commonly involve an invocation of a Greek deity, Asclepius, the god of healing. And so you'd have, apparently, based on what he said, you'd have, you know, like Christian doctors saying, I swear by Asclepius, I'm not going to do this or that as part of my medical practice. And the thing is, these doctors were Christian, and they didn't believe Asclepius even existed. And so this wasn't an act for them of literally invoking a pagan deity, because they didn't believe that there was such a deity.
Right.
Now, personally, if I were a doctor, that would give you know, as a Christian, that would give me the willies. But when I think about it objectively, if you don't really believe in this pagan god and you're just doing this for some other reason, then it would be like acting in a play where you could be playing a pagan and say, you know, oh, by Jove. And, you know, as an actor, you don't believe Jove exists. But as a play, the character that you're playing does believe that Jove exists, but you're not really swearing by Jove. You're really acting out a part for some other reason, namely to play this character in a play. And so you wouldn't be morally accountable for, as long as your motive is otherwise good, you wouldn't be accountable for invoking a pagan deity, because that's not what you did. You were acting a part. And so if as part of your sorority initiation rituals or whatever, you didn't believe that Hera exists, and you were just acting out this part, and everybody knew you didn't believe Hera existed, they didn't really worship the Greek gods at this sorority, then you weren't giving scandal to other people. So, you know, even though I understand the discomfort here, and I would certainly share that discomfort myself, I couldn't say that, oh, you definitely did something wrong there, provided those stipulations that I mentioned are all met. And so I don't know, you know, if there's more involved in the things that you think are problematic from a Catholic perspective with this sorority, but basically you've got a judgment call to make. If they're sufficiently incompatible with the Catholic faith, then I would say take your jewelry and your things like that and either throw it away or melt it down or, you know, something like that. Maybe you could get some money for the gold in it or the silver in it. Or if you determine that the sorority was fundamentally wholesome, and it sounds like you've not made that determination, but the opposite, then you could donate or pass on the stuff. But ultimately, you need to make your best judgment without scrupling about it and act on it and move forward with your life and entrust the decision to God.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Sure thing.
Thank you, Beth. Thanks very much. It's interesting what you said, Jim, because this weekend doing a little spring cleaning. I do my spring cleaning in July because I'm a procrastinator. Throughout The God Delusion, Richard Dawkins' book.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I had read it and I had two copies of it, so I don't want to give it to somebody.
Right, exactly. You could give it to an apologist who might not have it, but...
Oh, sorry.
Actually, I could have... I've already got it, so... On top of that.
Oh, I see what you're saying, Jimmy. I should have given it to you. No, I didn't even think about that. I was just like, nah.
Not me, but someone here might not have it. Right. Who could make use of it.
It went into the recycle pile.
Okay.
So it'll become a tree or something. I don't know what happens to the recycled stuff, but I think it becomes trees. Maybe I don't understand science, though. Maybe my science is off on that. Chris, in Chillicate, Ohio, listening on the EWTN app, you are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question.
Yes. In reading the narrative of the Old Testament, there are a couple instances in Genesis chapter 4 after the birth of Seth. It says, when people started calling on the name of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, Abram calls on the name of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
What name were they calling on, since God's name is not revealed until the time that he reveals it to Moses?
It's an interesting question. There are a number of interpretive possibilities, and there's not a clear answer here. It could be any number of things. One possibility is that the earlier references that say they called on the name of the Lord just mean they invoked God in some general way, but without using the specific name Yahweh. That's kind of an artifact of the later author. That's how they would have said it. It's kind of like, you know, let's say Batman has a secret identity. You know, it was Bruce Wayne. And at some stage, let's say, you know, during most of comic book history, Bruce's identity as Batman is not known. And so I could have Bruce Wayne come over to my house and not realize it was Batman also. But then later on, Bruce Wayne could become publicly known as Batman. And at that later date, so now that I know Bruce Wayne is Batman, I could say, can you believe it? Batman came over to my house.
Yeah, right.
Meaning he came over to my house as Bruce Wayne, even though I didn't yet know him as Batman. And in the same way, these patriarchal figures before the time of Moses, obviously they worshiped God in some way. But if they didn't yet know his name because it hadn't been revealed, then when it refers to them calling on the name of the Lord before the name Yahweh has been revealed, which is what it says in Hebrew where it says Lord in English is Yahweh,
yeah.
Then it could be like saying Bruce Wayne or Batman came over to my house even though I didn't yet know he was Batman at that time. So it could just mean the patriarchs worshiped Yahweh even though they didn't know him under that name at the time. Another possibility is to focus on the revelation to Moses of God's name and say, okay, well, literally the name Yahweh was known before this time. But when it says God revealed his name to Moses, it was a special revelation of some kind that it's like he manifested not just the literal name, but his merciful character to Moses or something, or he manifested himself as Yahweh in some new fashion. Could be Moses didn't know the name or something, or the people of his generation had forgotten it even though it had already been used, and so it was a new revelation in that sense. So there are a number of possibilities here. It's not clear which one of these is to be preferred, if any are to be preferred, but there are some possibilities.
Thank you very much, Chris, for that call. We have to take a quick break. You're aware Batman's not real, right? I didn't.
What?
You're not? We're going to have to talk at the break. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Your number one source for Catholic apologetics and evangelization, Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Cy Kellett, and I'm here to tell you about a very special promotion we look forward to every year, our annual store-wide summer sale in the online shop at Catholic.com. The spectacular online event includes savings of 10 to 50% and more in some cases on every book, tract, CD, DVD, ebook, and MP3 we carry, including all the newest resources from my good friends Tim Staples, Jimmy Akin, Trent Horn, and Carlo Broussard. With lower prices and a great selection, it's by far the best online Catholic sale of the summer. So log on now and all this month at shop.catholic.com and take advantage of our very special prices. You know it's all good stuff because it's from the people you know and trust at Catholic Answers.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Matthew 11:28, Jesus says, "Come to me, all you who labor and are burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am meek and humble of heart, and you will find rest for yourselves, for my yoke is easy and my burden light." Do you feel exhausted and weary? Here's the antidote. Jesus is actually inviting us to join him in taking on the yoke of a beast of burden. He promises that such humility will actually bring us rest. Rest from what? I suggest that it is rest from the stress and futility of our slavery to our egos. It was through humility that He chose to bear the burden of our sins. It is only through humility that we can appreciate what this means, and so realize how much He truly loves us. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Thanks for being with us today for Open Forum. One more segment of Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest, powering through. Actually, this is your third hour of Open Forum today.
It is.
Because
we did a pre-record earlier.
Yeah, but we're going to be out later in the summer, and so we did a pre-record. So together we have done almost three hours of Open Forum
in
today.
Just a little over 3 hours. So.
And you have shown a remarkable tolerance, because I think I've gotten goofier and goofier over the course of the 3 hours. I'm almost at my nadir.
You're doing great.
All right. We go now to, I never know about this anonymous thing.
Sharing my thought on the air, I don't understand why, and I've even suggested maybe we should just propose names to people when they call. I mean, I understand people
wanting to use a fake name with them.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, authors have pen names. Call in. If you're a male, say your name is Bob. If you're a female, say your name is Jane. It doesn't really matter. The important thing is your question, and that's what we want to help you with.
That's right. And sometimes I don't know what the question is yet.
Let's just say we've got Bob in Houston here.
But we're going to call him Bob?
Yeah.
Anonymous Bob?
Yep.
Can we call him Robert?
I don't want to be too casual with Bob.
We don't know him yet.
Actually, what I'm reffing on is the complete works of William Shakespeare abridged, where they call everybody Bob, even the women.
Oh, okay. So, because I was going to say maybe we could find an androgynous name. We could find
like Chris or Pat or something easy like that.
Yeah. It's Pat.
We'll do Bob.
Okay.
Welcome to the show, Bob.
From Houston, Texas. Your question, please.
Hi. You can call me Karen.
Oh, you're not Bob.
Thank you so much. No, anonymous. You have to choose any name. I'll say Karen. Thank you so much for all that you do. That God continue to bless you, and I thank you for the opportunity. I've come back after 30 years.
Wonderful.
Yay.
Of being clueless. And today's 1 week since I went to confession for the first time.
Thanks for sharing that with us.
We have it's a little hard to hear you. We're getting some echo or some background or something. What's your question so we can help you out?
Okay. I'm just wondering, I've been hearing that we're not to eat meat on Fridays, and I thought that was only during Lent. So is it every Friday throughout the year? And does that apply to just meat, or does it apply to all the byproducts of milk, cheese, and any other thing related?
So the way that the church's law of abstinence, and that's what this is, abstinence from meat, the way it's presently written in the United States, because this varies from country to country, but the way the law on this is presently written in the United States, we are to abstain from meat, and I'll talk about what that is in a minute, but we're to abstain from meat on Ash Wednesday and the Fridays of Lent. That's the general obligation. In terms of other Fridays of the year, they are days of penance, but the U.S. bishops have not determined any particular way of celebrating penance on those days, and they have not imposed an obligation on us to pick something. They are days of penance in the sense that the church commemorates them as days of penance, but that doesn't create a specific legal obligation on you to do anything. You'll sometimes hear people say that, you have to do something else on those days. That's not the way the law is written. That's a common impression, but it is not the way the law is written. On those days where we do have an obligation to abstain from meat, which, as I said, is in this country in the Latin Rite of the Church, is Ash Wednesday and the Fridays of Lent, including Good Friday, we're to abstain from the flesh of animals, meaning land animals and birds, but fish is not included. Animal fat is not included, so you don't have to worry about, you know, did someone use bacon grease or lard or something in your food? You don't have to worry about that. Also, surprisingly, soups made with meat do not count under this. But if a dish other than soup contains the flesh of like birds or land animals, then you should abstain from it under ordinary circumstances. There are exceptions here and there, usually based on local law and custom, like apparently, and this example I'm about to mention apparently goes back to like frontier days in, I think, Michigan, like you can have muskrat, even though it's a land animal.
Because even though it's a mammal, swims so much.
Well, yeah, and also just there was a time when, for complex historical reasons, the local bishop like gave permission for that, and it's kind of stuck.
Oh.
so it doesn't really make sense. But for the most part, it's basically land animals and birds, and as long as you stay away from those things, it'll be fine.
Okay, Bob Anonymous?
Karen Anonymous.
Okay. Karen Anonymous, okay.
All right, well, thank you very much. And I'm going to continue to move quickly because...
And call again when we can be of service.
Yes, that's a very exciting confession after 30 years. It's wonderful to have you. A question from the Facebook that I want to get to real quick,
okay.
Jimmy, before... A woman, she's a teacher. She does catechesis in the Philippines.
Oh,
And one of the children was from a non-Catholic denomination and asked if that denomination, and it's called Iglesia Ni Cristo, just so you know.
Okay.
Do they have the same God with Catholics? And she said, she answered, I'm not an expert on that religion, but I can tell you about the God of Catholics. She wants to know, did she commit apostasy by saying that?
By saying that she's not sure whether Iglesia Ni Cristo has the same God?
Yes, that's what she wants to know.
That wouldn't constitute apostasy. The only way that you commit apostasy is if you say, I personally am no longer a Christian. As long as you say, I'm a Christian, even if you're wrong about whatever else you said, you did not commit apostasy. And
as a matter of fact, this
seems
like
talking about somebody else and saying, I'm not sure if they have the same God or us is not, that you're not saying, I am not a Christian. Saying, I am not a Christian is the only way you can commit apostasy. I mean, saying that doesn't have to be in those words, but fundamentally rejecting the Christian faith so that you no longer identify as a Christian, that's what apostasy is.
And it struck me that this actually might actually be a very wise answer that she gave.
I don't know.
I don't know that, but I can tell you about the Catholic God.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's see if we can get a call in real quick before we go. We'll go to Sandy in Sharon Springs, New York, listening on 89.9 FM. Sandy, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. My question is, in the Synoptic Gospels, mm-hmm. in the list of the apostles, Luke's name does not appear, even in the Gospel of Luke. Does he go by another name?
Not that we're aware of. I mean, Luke, apparently, from what we can tell, was not an apostle. Now, there were apostles who were beyond the 12, like St. Paul and St. Barnabas were both apostles but were not part of the 12. And the term apostle is used somewhat more flexibly than we might suppose today, but we don't have early references to Luke being an apostle. Instead, he's normally referred to as being a companion of an apostle, specifically the apostle Paul. And so, and the same thing is true of Mark. He was like a companion initially of Paul and later a companion of Peter. And so when their writings were incorporated into the New Testament, it was understood that they weren't themselves apostles, but they were companions of apostles. And so their writings were sort of done under the aegis of those apostles. So Peter presumably approved of Mark's gospel, and Paul presumably approved of Luke's gospel. And so even though the two authors were not themselves apostles, there's still a kind of apostolic authority behind their writings.
I never knew that.
Okay. Yeah, and by the way, so Luke, if you go online and say go to BibleGateway.com or something and type Luke into the search field, you can even turn up the passages in Paul's writings where he mentions Luke. There's a couple of them. And also if you read in Acts, there are certain passages known as the we passages where Luke says, we went here and we did this, where he was apparently present for those events as a companion of Paul.
Thank you so much for that call. Tomorrow on Catholic Answers Live, Dr. Stacy Trisankos will be with us, pretty much our favorite Catholic scientist. We're going to talk about, does science trash pro-life arguments? Can you still make good pro-life arguments in the face of what science knows about the early stages of human development? And then Jason Evert will be here to talk about chastity after that. Jimmy Akin, I had a really enjoyable 3 hours with you today. Thanks very much.
Likewise, with you.
All right, we should do this again sometime. Maybe next
Sounds
Tuesday.
Great.
Okay. See you tomorrow on Catholic Answers Live.